This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. It's Health and Living on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. With me is our doctor in the house, Dr. George Lee, for the second part of a personality piece on a very special guest, Sir Roy Khan, surgeon, artist and author. Last week, we spoke about the story behind the pioneering of organ transplantation and immunosuppressant drugs as Dr. George and Sir Roy Khan reminisce about the good old days of frontier medicine. Today, we continue the discussion with the future of healthcare.
Prof, do you remember the first patient that you successfully transplanted and then, after the discovery of the immunosuppression?
I do remember the early cases, and one of my early patients met me at a cocktail party recently, and she said, "You don't know."
Recently?
She said, "You don't know who I am. You don't remember, do you?" And I said, "Well, I don't actually." And she said, "You transplanted my kidney 45 years ago, and it's still doing well, and it was from an unrelated donor before we had tissue typing even." So she's made a big impression on me. She's just had her 70th birthday. We're going to have a big celebration and try and use it as an occasion to get public support for organ donation.
How did that make you feel when you met this guy? This lady 45 years later.
Well, she remembered it very well because there were no beds available, no operating room space, and I did the operation in the Royal Air Force Hospital at Halton.
In the middle of the night.
It's always in the middle of the night. But she remembers very well being moved out of Addenbrooke's Hospital in Cambridge to the RAF station because that was they very kindly made their facilities available.
Nothing much has changed then about bed space and also.
I don't think you'll find it easy to operate in an RAF station now.
But there was something else that I was curious about, and that is whether you view the role of a surgeon as changing. Because you're a surgeon, as you rightly point out, but now you're also a researcher, you're doing all these different things, and keyhole surgery, you know, that someone claimed was impossible and isn't. And I don't know, you know, with all these different technologies entering the picture now, where you can kind of remotely operate on somebody, has the role of a surgeon fundamentally changed?
I think it is changing, yes. I think you've put your finger on a very important question because when I was training, the surgeon would do almost any kind of operation. And although it was beginning to get specialized when I was in the process of training, I still would operate on thyroids, on stomachs, on gangrenous legs, and breast surgery. I did everything, really, maybe not that well. But now it's so specialized that surgeons are confined to a much narrower area. And as you say, keyhole surgery means that the technique is a bit more remote from the patient. So it's the patients don't stay in hospital very long and often don't get to know the staff in the hospital the way they used to. So they're delighted, I suppose, to get out of hospital quickly. But sometimes they get out of hospital too quickly.
Mm. Sometimes we're trying to push the boundary too much. I still remember, Prof, in the late 80s and early 90s, that was when the laparoscopic surgery was about to take off. And then everybody thought that it was crazy to operate on such small hole for the laparoscopic cholecystectomy and also for hernia operation.
And now patients know to ask for it.
That's right. And then I used to, the old style surgeon used to say, "Oh, a real surgeon operate with real knife and then there were real wound," but these days it becomes
and this idea that surgeons are confined to a narrower area, that they're becoming more specialized, is that a good thing?
Well, I think that as far as the specialist area is concerned, it's a very good thing. It means that if you are specialized in, say, knee surgery, you become extremely good knee surgery and the anatomy and the physiology of the knee, but you might not be so good if you're in running of a hospital, if you're called up at night to get somebody who's got, say, a ruptured aneurysm or a stomach trouble or a heart attack. So you will find that your expertise is being driven into a corner. And so that means you need a lot more doctors.
Super specialization. I mean, in urology,
yes,
in the States,
that's
right. In urology in the States, they will have a robotic surgeon who will operate on robotics patients who actually needs to be operated on robotic devices. If anything goes wrong, they actually have a separate team of open surgeon who will come in and bail them out. So you touch on a very interesting question to actually say that, you know, super specialization, is that the way forward? On one hand, it's good. On the other hand, it actually may not have that broad experience in bailing oneself out.
Well, as a urologist, do you feel that way? That you are kind of, that you've kind of been narrowed down into a super specialized area?
Well, like, for example, the commonest operation I do are stones operations. And then, so, you know, endoscopic laser stones operation. And unfortunately, when I do face with problems, and then I do find that, you know, the last time, for example, that I did an open operation, let's say for partial kidney removal of a cancer, for example, was a while ago. So I do have some reservation whenever I want to embark on that.
That's something, okay.
Yeah, it's something that actually, like Prof was saying, that the training has to accommodate for that sort of super specialization, but yet you need more doctors to deal with different...
To cover all the bases, really.
My next question is also really for both of you, and it's something that I find fascinating about doctors, because I feel like there is so much out there right now in terms of information, in terms of research, in terms of just sheer quantity of stuff coming at you. How do you keep up? I mean, Sir Roy, I just, you know, my mind is blown by the idea of being kind of in my 80s and still, you know, trying to keep up with, oh, okay, gene therapy over here, and, you know, there's a team doing this over here, and just being able to keep track of all these things.
What How drives do you, you
yeah.
Sir Roy?
That's a question I don't think I can answer. I think my personality is a little bit like being a dog with a bone, that you keep hold of it and keep on going as long as you can. I feel as long as I've got something to contribute, I want to keep going. But I think the question is a serious one, and I think it's an important one. But keeping up with it, I don't keep up with the wide literature. I just keep up focused with the literature relating to what I'm doing. But I do reasonably wide science reading. I read Nature. I read The Lancet. So I have got a vague idea of what's happening in science and what's happening in medicine. But as far as the specialist literature is concerned in gene therapy, that is a very narrow reading area.
Well, one thing that, Lynn, your first question, how did Sir Roy and I keep in touch with each other? When I was working at University of Malaya, and then Sir Roy actually comes all the way to Southeast Asia and actually helped with the transplant program. So apart from research work that related to transplant and non-transplant, he also was actively involved in our transplant program and operating on those patients and actually disseminating his expertise and his information. And that was a reason why we kind of kept in touch again 20 years later. And that is an extraordinary thing that I want to say. Apart from actually research itself, you're also helping out countries and different programs to take off. And then, you know, I just found that quite amazing, Prof, that you continue to do that.
What is that knowledge sharing like? You know, going to another country with possibly a different sort of setup, different skill sets, different levels of training, and imparting that?
I think it can be difficult, even with language. For instance, in the University of Malaya, a lot of the nurses had very little English, and I had very
And you learned Malay, right? along the way.
I had very little Malay. So I think that there are special difficulties in that. And so to have somebody like George around who familiar with both languages and cultures, makes it much easier. And I mean, my role was really just to help things get things going rather than to take it over.
Up next, we explore Sir Roy Khan's artistic side. You're listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. It's Health and Living on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin, together with Dr. In the House, Dr. George Lee, as well as Sir Roy Khan, surgeon, artist, and author. We've been discussing everything from organ transplants and immunology to ethics in medical research. Now we're continuing the conversation with Sir Roy Khan as an author and an artist. We were talking earlier about your reading, but it's not just reading that you do, but writing. What led you to write books and so on?
Well, I was involved in writing surgical books for a long time, and our book on general surgery has just had its 50th anniversary. That's with Prof. Ellison.
That's right. And that is a book that every single medical student, even up to today, are actually, this is a must-have, they must read, because so to pass your anatomy exam, you have to have that book.
So it's its 13th edition. So actually, Professor Ellis was my boss, and he just told me to help him write the book. So. more recently, I've been interested in other aspects of the junction between society, science, and I wrote a book on the population explosion called Too Many People. I wrote a book on skepticism.
You published that about
a long time ago.
A long time ago. Then when I was in medical school, I think I read that book published that.
All the terrible things I thought would happen have happened.
Yes, we have far too many people.
Far too many people. And you saw that 30 years ago.
And then I also wrote a book on skepticism and the value of skepticism, but also the dangers of too much skepticism. But then this recent book that I published is on a different aspect of the. It's not so much a fight between science and human nature. It's just an incompatibility. So human nature, I don't think, has changed. Most people get along reasonably well. A few are very, very altruistic and good, and a few are unbelievably terrible. And this has always been the case, and there's always been conflict in human society, as in many animal societies. But science in the last 100 years has rocketed at a fantastic speed. And, quantum physics is an example of an area of science that didn't exist or didn't have any practical applications yet. Anybody who uses a computer or a cell phone will be practically using quantum physics. So I think that science, every advance in science is, the scientist usually thinks that it's going to help humanity, help make people have a happier life. But there also will always be people who will think, well, maybe we could get a spin-off of this to make a weapon. And so the weapons of destruction have proliferated and they continue to proliferate. And some of them are very fearful. So this book, The Ratchet of Science, really sums up this idea that everything that's described in science, once it's out, it's like the genie out of the bottle. You can't put it back again. Mm. However, the amount of damage that a few people can do with the applications of science is increasing at a fantastic rate. And so that's the kind of basis of this book. Can we cope with these advances in science, with drones that can be handled with a computer in one continent and have an effect in another continent? I mean, these are new types of weaponry which would seem to me to be perhaps beyond our control unless we think very seriously about it.
It's quite scary.
Mm.
It's very scary.
That's right.
I think very is the word for it. It's not just writing. It's not just writing that you do, but art as well. And I understand that you've chosen to use your transplant patients as subjects for your art. Why was that choice made?
It was really I've always been interested in painting and more recently in sculpture, but we did liver transplant on a patient, John Bellany, a very well-known Scottish painter. And he did 60 paintings of himself, what it was like to be a liver transplant recipient. And he and I became friends, and he gave me some lessons for a bit, and then he suddenly stopped giving me lessons.
Because you got better than him.
Well, I got similar to him. I think he didn't like that.
When was this?
This was 26, 27 years ago.
Right.
And then it seemed to me we had one lesson he gave me when he painted me and I painted him. And he had, in his paintings of himself, he portrayed himself as a very saintly kind of person being tortured by the doctors, like Saint Sebastian. And I painted him like a very, very sick patient who could just about hold his head up, and it was, we were all trying to help him. So it was completely different. The same image looked at completely differently. And then it occurred to me that I had a captive or audience of models, potential models, patients, particularly children. I found that children love to be drawn and then criticized instead of being terrified of doctors. And also, I'm quite interested in the perception of an image. So if you can imagine an operating theatre, and if I came into an operating theatre, I would be interested in what stage is the operation, how's it going, what's the blood loss, and so on. If an anaesthetist comes in, he wants to know whether the oxygen saturation is all right, whether the intravenous lines are good, and the general aspects of an operating anaesthetist, the things that he was interested in. And if a nurse came in, a senior nurse, she would be interested to know that all the instruments were in the right spot at the right time, ready to be used. And then we had a rather distinguished journalist who came in, and she just fainted. So
Would you care to share with us her name?
No, I think not.
We shall not. Okay. I mean, so basically, what inspired you initially to paint was a patient's kind of perspective of, you know.
Well, it was, I, as far as the painting my patients were concerned, it was certainly John Bellany who enthused me with this idea. But I had always painted, and I always liked to teach graphically. Drawing an operation, I always
to patients whenever you demonstrate
and
things,
also to patients. But always in my operating notes, I'd have a little diagram of what I'd done.
That's right. I never dare to ask you all that time. Whenever Adam Brooke Hospital's corridor, we had all your paintings there, and then I thought you actually were having perspective of different people. Like early on, what you were describing, the nurses' focus were on the instruments. Mm. The anaesthetist patients, you know, were from the head upwards onwards, and yours was the, you know, the blood loss and the patients
and the technical
that sort of thing.
Aspect of the.
That's right. I always thought that was your focus whenever you looked at it, and you branch out obviously to paint other things. Mm. What's your favorite kind of like painting that you've done so far?
I suppose I had a commission from the University of Dallas to do a painting to commemorate some important event in the history of their transplant work. And I did a painting of the operation, which on the lines of some of the ones you probably know. And that was in the top half. And the bottom half was an intensive care nurse who was looking at the patient with great concern but also great compassion. So it was trying to put together the technical side of the surgery of a transplant operation and the nursing side of compassion and care of the patient to put them together in the same image.
Between writing, art, and medicine, moving forward, you know, where do you see your interests going? Where do you see, what do you see yourself exploring? There's so much.
Well, I think that at the moment, it's certainly the gene therapy that is the most exciting and focused idea of my work, especially since it seems to be moving in the right direction. But we've made so many mistakes in the past that we'll probably make more mistakes in the future. So I'm not overconfident.
So that's your main passion at the moment. I mean, you're traveling halfway around the world to give lectures in Japan, mm-hmm. and in Singapore, in Malaysia, which is what you're here in town for, to give a lecture. And then, I mean, I'm sure all these is driven by passion, isn't it? To disseminate information, to actually tell the world about the breakthrough, mm-hmm. and also the work that you're doing. I mean, it's obviously along the way you make many friends.
That's
as well.
Right, and pupils like yourself.
All right, thank you.
meeting pupils again and finding how successful they are.
All right.
Very proud of your success. Oh,
thank you. I mean, obviously during this time you are, first of all, driven by your own passion about, essentially making discovery in medicine to change a landscape, which is what you've been doing for the last 60, 70 years. And then on the other hand, along the way, you enjoy coming to Malaysia, going to enjoy the food and the friendship and that sort of thing. And then would that continue to be the drive that you will continue to kind of flourish and then enjoy?
Well, as long as I can, yes.
Right.
And finally, to close off the show, because sadly we're running out of time, what advice would you offer for young Dr. Georges listening, people who are young practicing doctors or medical students listening and thinking, I'd like that career, I'd want to be, still that interested and that passionate later on in my life?
Well, I think that the actual fulfillment in medicine, if you are helping somebody who's sick, frightened, pain, with suffering from pain, if you can help them, then that is a tremendous fulfillment and the main fulfillment of medicine. I think as far as research is concerned, I wouldn't push youngsters into doing research because I don't think they do well unless they really want to do it. So I always tell many of my colleagues don't agree with this, but I will always tell them, if you really want to do research, please do it, and I'll help you as much as I can. But I don't think that everybody should do research just because it's something that should be done. And usually that research ends up without any good result.
Yeah, rather than a tick box exercise, because I think too many doctors are probably embarking on this career because they have to rather than they want
to.
Yeah,
I would agree.
Yeah.
So, Roy, thank you very much for your time.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. George.
My pleasure. I mean, Prof, I just wanted to say that this is a great opportunity for us to pay tribute to a lot of work that you've done, especially for our Malaysian patients, and also, the great work that you've done for medicine. And I always remember a few things, that you said when I was a medical student. You told me that, if we are always worried about obstacles, there will never be transplantation. And the second thing you told me was that if life, there's no ifs, so don't just worry about don't have regrets in the future, and then looking back and then wondering what life would be like if there was if you have done so. And lastly, you said to me, life is about the journey, not the destination. Thank you so much for your guidance.
Well, I'm very glad you've remembered some of the things.
Some of it has stuck.
That's right. Okay. And helped me a lot in my career and also my life. Thank you.
You've been listening today to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.